The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Welcome to Nobody Told Me. I'm Jan Black.
And I'm Laura Owens, and we're really excited about our next guest, Amy Morin. She's a psychotherapist and the author of 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, an international best-selling book that's being translated into more than 25 languages, as well as 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do. Her TED Talk, The Secret of Becoming Mentally Strong, has had more than 6 million views. She's also a columnist for Inc., Forbes, and Psychology Today. Welcome to the show, Amy.
Well, thanks for having me.
Amy, there's a fascinating story about how your first book, 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, came about. Tell us about that.
So I was a therapist, and I had thought my goal in life was just going to be about teaching other people to be mentally strong, but I went through a series of losses in my life. My mother passed away suddenly from a brain aneurysm when I was 23. And then on the 3-year anniversary of her death, my 26-year-old husband died of a heart attack.
Oh my gosh.
And so at some point, my journey with mental strength really became personal. I figured out, okay, it's not just about teaching other people these skills. I also need to practice them in my own life. And throughout seeing people in my therapy office over the years, I figured out sometimes resilience wasn't always about what people did, but sometimes it was more about what they didn't do. And so I practiced not just developing good habits, but getting rid of bad habits that would keep me stuck. And then a few years down the road, I was fortunate to find love again. I got remarried and life was looking good. And my father-in-law was diagnosed with terminal cancer. And to get through that, while we were dealing with what we knew was about to happen, the doctors gave him a few weeks to a couple of months left to live. I wrote myself a list of all the things mentally strong people don't do. And it was a way to remind myself not to do these certain things so that I could stay as strong as possible. And I published it to the web thinking maybe it would help somebody else, but it was read by more than 50 million people.
Wow.
And so then I was fortunate to then be able to go on and write the book and sort of explain the backstory, because when the list came out, it was pretty much just the list. Nobody knew why I wrote it. They thought I wrote it because I had mastered it, not because I struggled with it. And so just a few days after my father-in-law passed away, I was on national TV talking about mental strength, but nobody really knew the backstory. So I was thrilled to be able to write the book and explain, hey, we all struggle with these things, but giving them up can help you to become stronger. And when you're on top of those issues, you can be aware of them and figure out, how do I give up these bad habits so that I can be the best version of myself?
And how did you come up with the 13 things?
They were all things that, I'd seen again over in my therapy office. I thought, okay, when people don't do these things, like when they don't feel sorry for themselves, they seem to bounce back better. And some people had been through lots of really tough things in their life, and yet they were still had hope. They were just resilient. They wanted to make their lives better despite terrible things that they'd gone through. And then I'd see some other people who weren't able to do that. Something happened to them and they just stayed stuck. So I tried to figure out what was the difference between these people and the people who struggled more. And I just never written, I think, all these things down at once. And so in that moment, when I found like I needed to make sure I gave up those bad habits, I wrote down the list, and it was the first time I'd really seen it on paper. I didn't mean for there to be 13. There was no magic. A lot of people ask me if I purposely had 13. It wasn't. It was just how many I had come up with by the time I was down the list.
You say that your brain can be your biggest asset or your worst enemy. Explain more about that.
Well, studies will show we have something like 60,000 thoughts per day. Well, a lot of those thoughts are the same things over and over again, and we get into these certain patterns. So if you're somebody who calls yourself names, you're somebody who talks yourself out of doing things, like maybe you think I'm such a loser, I'll never get a promotion, it affects how you feel and it affects how you behave. So it's really important to figure out, first of all, pay attention to those patterns and then figure out how do you change them. Sometimes it's a matter of just reframing your thoughts. Sometimes it's talking back to the negativity. And most importantly, it can be about talking to yourself like you talk to a trusted friend. If you spent those 60,000 thoughts building yourself up and encouraging yourself, you can accomplish a lot more compared to when you're calling yourself names and beating yourself up and coming up with all sorts of reasons why you shouldn't try to go on and make changes in your life.
You said one of the most profound things that I have ever heard in my life, which is instead of living life like it's your last day, try to live life like it's everyone else's last day. How does this change your thinking?
You know, I think so many of us don't want to plan ahead. We don't want to plan for the future. We just go through life thinking about ourselves. And to really then be able to think, well, what would I do? How would you treat other people around you if you knew that today was their last day? Would you still be irritated and angry? Would you?
You'd be nicer to a person on the street, not even family and friends. You'd just be nicer to random people.
You know, to have some compassion for people. I remember when my father-in-law, we knew he probably had a matter of weeks left. And I was visiting him and we were at the airport and he had gone to pick me up at the airport with some family when I flew in. And he got out of the car to give me a hug. And the car behind us was beeping the horn because they were in a hurry and they wanted him to get out of the way. And I just remember thinking, these people have no idea that you know, this man probably has a couple of weeks left on the planet if he's fortunate. But just what a terrible thing for us to be so impatient with people.
Well, I'm wondering how you advise people to embrace a happier outlook when their world is falling apart or may have already fallen apart. How do you do that?
Part of it, I think, is just remembering that we all go through tough times. It's easy to think my problems are worse than anybody else's or to think I can't handle this. This isn't fair. But those are the kinds of thoughts that will keep you stuck and make you feel worse. And then it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy that you'll never make your life any better. So it's really about thinking, okay, I can do this. I can get through it. I can get stronger, even when it does feel like the world's falling apart. Part of life. We all have bumps in the road and horrible things that happen, but you don't have to let it reduce you or you don't have to let it limit the kind of life that you want to live, but to just focus on how can I come out the other side and be okay.
And what role does our language play in this? Because you talk about how your response gives you power.
Anything, the way that you think definitely plays a huge role. And sometimes it's just those little words that we use. So when you say something like, oh, I have to go to the grocery store today, you give away some of your power. Actually, you get to go to the grocery store. How fortunate that you have money that you can spend and food that you can buy at a store. And just making that shift about saying, okay, I get to do this today rather than I have to. Or I'll hear people say, you know, I have to go to work tomorrow. Nope, that's a choice too. And when you just make that shift and recognize everything you do from the time you wake up until the time you go to bed is a choice and there's consequences for your choices, but that it's up to you, it can make a huge difference. And I hear a lot of people who will give away their power in terms of letting other people control how they think, feel, or behave. So if somebody says, my boss drags me down or my coworker is so annoying, it ruins my day, then you give people power over you. So to just recognize nobody can make you feel anything. So the next time you're tempted to say, my mother-in-law makes me feel bad about myself, remember that she's not making you do anything. It's up to you to say, how do I feel about myself or what kind of day am I going to have?
Why do you think we fall into the trap of dwelling on the negative in the first place? I mean, is it something that comes about when we're kids or is it something that we pick up from television or outside influences? Where does it come from?
I think it's a combination. Sometimes our experiences when we think, okay, I was hopeful before and things didn't work out, so I don't want to get my hopes up this time. I see a lot of people who feel like that, people who think, well, if I assume the worst and then something good happens, well, then I'll be surprised. But if it doesn't happen, at least I won't be let down. And for a lot of people, it just becomes a way of life. And of course, it's contagious. When you're surrounded by people who grumble and complain, it rubs off on you and it can affect the way that you think because you'll start to grumble and complain too. and see the world a little bit darker than you did before. And I think sometimes people get confused. They think that being optimistic is about seeing everything through rose-colored glasses, but that's not true either. You don't want to enter situations being overconfident, or you don't want to always tell yourself things are going to work out great because they're not. But you can be realistic and still be hopeful and still optimistic at the same time by looking at the good. But I see a lot of people who are cautious about that. They think that you have to be on one end or the other. So I always encourage people to find a realistic yet optimistic outlook in life so that you can say, okay, I can be hopeful, but I also am going to be realistic. If I'm applying for a new job, I can't control whether or not they hire me, but I can control how prepared I am in walking in for the interview.
Something that I really, really wanted to get into with you is the impact of Facebook jealousy. So you started off your TED Talk by saying, so I have a Facebook friend and her life looks perfect. And I feel like for millennials like myself, this is such a common thought that we have that, you know, if we're dealing with some sort of pain, somehow looking at somebody else's social media is a way of avoiding our own emotions. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, it's an interesting phenomenon how much time most people spend on social media. And studies will show that most people assume I'm going to feel better because of a distraction from my work, or I'll just check and see what people are doing right now. But studies show that, in fact, it tends to make us feel a lot worse. And it's interesting to see the things that make us feel bad about ourselves. It's other people's birthdays. If you look at how many people wished your friend a happy birthday, that tends to make us feel bad.
Interesting.
Looking at your friend's vacation photos tends to make you feel worse because you think, oh, it's so lovely that they get to go to all of these places and have lots of fun, and I don't get to do that, or I'm a loser because I've never been to that place. And it can just be little things, too. Other people, when they are talking about how great their kids are, or how proud they are of their spouse for getting a promotion, that sort of thing, it affects the way that we think, because then we think, well, I don't have all that great stuff going on. And we forget that Facebook isn't reality. It's just somebody's snapshot of their life, and they're not sharing the picture before the one that you see where everybody was fighting and crying, or they don't tell you about the day-to-day struggles that they're experiencing. Most people just announce the great stuff that's going on. And when we see that, studies show that envying people on Facebook is actually linked to depression. And I see a lot of people in my therapy office who feel like they can't put their phone down, and they're on it all the time, and their anxiety is through the roof, or they feel like everybody else has a better life than they do. So I think it's really crucial for us to examine, what role does social media play in my life?
Are there ways to change how we perceive somebody else's life on social media? Or do you think we just need to avoid Facebook and Instagram and Snapchat altogether?
I don't think we need to avoid it altogether, because certainly I think if we got back to what we think social media is, which is socializing with other people, I think it could actually be good for our mental health if we talked to people and connected with them and then made real life plans rather than just scrolling through and looking at what everybody else is doing, or having 800 connections, but you really don't know that many of them. That sort of thing isn't particularly helpful. So I think using it in moderation and monitoring yourself, how's your mood before you get on it? And then how's your mood afterward? And just really taking a look at that. And for a lot of people, they think, well, I keep wasting time on it. When I'm at work, I'm bored, or when I'm doing something that isn't particularly exciting, I just pick up my phone and I don't even realize I'm doing it. I'm just mindlessly scrolling through it. Those are the things that actually take a huge toll on our mental health. So I think it's important to recognize how much time you're spending on it, and then to really take stock of how much does it affect my mood. And then to remind yourself when you start thinking, oh, that's not fair, or that person has a nicer car than I do, or they get to go do more fun things than I do, that they probably have lots of problems too, and you're not seeing the whole picture, and it doesn't necessarily mean that that person has a better life than you do.
Yeah, along those lines, you say that mentally strong people don't resent other people's success.
Yeah, when you think that other people have an awesome life and they maybe have a better job, they get paid more money, it can make you feel like, well, that person's taking things away from me, or that's not fair. We start to keep score and we think I deserve that more than that person does. And it's all of that kind of thinking that takes your eyes off of your own goals and interferes with your own happiness. And so it's really important to say, okay, maybe somebody else does have more money, or somebody has things that I wish I had in my own life, but they're not your competition. And if you just looked at other people more like your, more like their opinion holders. So maybe that person knows things you don't, and they could share that information with you rather than that person's better than I am. That can make a big difference.
What are the three types of destructive beliefs?
So if we were to divide up the 13 things mentally strong people don't do, they're bad habits, but they can be categorized into three types of unhealthy beliefs, which is unhealthy beliefs about ourselves, unhealthy beliefs about other people, and unhealthy beliefs about the world in general. So an unhealthy belief about ourselves might be, good things never happen to people like me. I'll never make it in the world. I could never be successful. Those types of thoughts that tend to become a self-fulfilling prophecy. And unhealthy beliefs about other people are when we start to think things like, everyone else has better luck than I do. Other people, you can never trust them because they just use you to get ahead in their own lives. Those types of thoughts, it makes it really hard to have healthy relationships. And we're social creatures. We need to have healthy relationships with other people. And then the unhealthy beliefs about the world, those can be about thinking, well, I wasn't born into a family of wealth, so I'll never make it. Or people who live in my part of the country just don't succeed in life. A lot of beliefs about that kind of stuff where people just think, well, people like me or the world that I live in just doesn't involve good luck. Things like that that makes it so that they just assume no matter what I do in life, it doesn't matter. It won't make a difference because the world, the universe is going to hold me back in some way or another.
You say that mentally strong people set aside time to be alone. And I'm wondering why you feel that is important and what we should try to accomplish when we are alone.
Well, it's important to be social. So, of course, you should be spending time with friends and family and face-to-face time. But on the other side of that, it's important to be comfortable in your own skin. And that can mean allowing yourself to just sit and think. I see a lot of people in my therapy office who will say, I sleep with the TV on because my mind won't shut off. And so I'll ask them, well, how much time do you spend thinking during the day? And the answer is usually zero, because they think it's a waste of time or they think, why would you do that? But your brain needs to process things. So even just 10 minutes a day of saying, I'm going to unplug from technology for a few minutes and just sit and think. And just maybe it's you meditate or maybe you think, well, what are my goals? Some people like to journal. Other people just want to sit down and just shut everything off, close their eyes for a few minutes and reflect on the day and think, what are my goals for tomorrow? But I think it's super important to learn, how do you be comfortable with your own thoughts? How do you allow yourself to just sit and think without all the distractions of everything else going on? And it's funny because I talk to some people who will say, well, I love alone time. But then I'll say, what do you do during your alone time? And they say, you know, I chat with my friends on social media or I'm watching TV. But I'm really talking about just being alone with your thoughts. And for some people, that's really scary. In fact, they did a study where they asked people, would you rather sit quietly and meditate for 15 minutes or would you rather be subjected to an electric shock? And 25% of women chose the electric shock, but almost 75% of men chose the electric shock over just sitting quietly with their own thoughts. So I think that speaks volumes about where we are as a society.
How do the mentally strong deal with issues in a relationship?
So a few things come to mind. One would be that they take responsibility for their feelings and for their behavior and for their thoughts without blaming the other person, but at the same time recognizing that when you're in a relationship, the other person's choices, they affect you. And to be able to talk about that, sometimes it's tempting to avoid our own emotions. So when I work with people who experience anxiety, they might constantly worry that their partner is cheating on them. If their partner's not right there in their sight. So then they're texting and they're calling and they're checking up on what their partner's doing, or maybe they are spying on their phone when their partner's in the shower, things like that, because it's about managing their own anxiety rather than making the relationship better. So when you're mentally strong and you're in a relationship, it's about saying, what can I do to keep working on the relationship? And yes, maybe I'm going to be anxious sometimes because there aren't any guarantees in a relationship, or my partner isn't going to always meet my needs, but I can handle that. I can handle feeling sad sometimes, and I'm still going to be lonely sometimes, and that's okay. But it's not necessarily my partner's fault that I feel those things, but that I'm willing to talk about them. We can address those issues together, but that I don't necessarily need somebody who completes me. I'm an okay person by myself, and when I'm in a relationship, that can help me to reach my goals, but at the same time, that person isn't solely responsible for my happiness.
Your latest book is called 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do, Raising Self-Assured Children and Training Their Brains for a Life of Happiness, Meaning, and Success. Share some insight, if you will, in terms of what parents shouldn't do if they'd like to raise a child for a life of happiness, meaning, and success.
So it's about how do you raise kids who will grow up to not do the 13 things mentally strong people don't do. I just kept getting the same question over and over again from readers of my first book, and they were asking me, how do we teach kids how to be mentally strong? And I had some parents who were hanging up the list of the 13 things on their kids' doors, or that they had their teenager reading through the first book with them, which is wonderful. And I could have written a book for kids, but I really wanted to write a book that would teach parents how to become mental strength coaches. And so in the book, I talk about, for example, the first chapter is that mentally strong parents don't condone a victim mentality. And that's because you want to raise a child who isn't going to grow up feeling sorry for himself or herself. You want to raise kids who know, okay, disappointment and rejection, those are part of life, but that's okay. I'm strong enough to handle it. And so this book is really about how do you find a balance so that you give kids enough life experience without exposing them to too much? And how do you make sure that you're a guide so that instead of protecting them from pain in life, you guide them and you help them figure out how do I deal with these things and how do I cope with my own emotions? There's a study that found that 60% of college kids say that they lack the emotional skills that they needed to be out on their own. So I think it's really needed right now for parents to learn about how to do these things. And so each chapter has lots of exercises for both parents and for the kids that build the mental muscle that kids are going to need when they grow up and enter the adult world.
And you did this fascinating article for Inc. that talked about how researchers found in this study that was done by the American Journal of Public Health that the child's social and emotional skills are what determine how likely the child is to go to college rather than jail. So it's not reading or writing.
Right. That the study discovered that kids at age 5 who could share and who could cooperate and who had pretty good emotional skills were much more likely to be successful when they were 25. And I think it speaks volumes about the opportunity that we have to start teaching kids now. How do you deal with feelings? And for parents, I think it's tempting when your child is upset, you want to calm her down. Or when your kids are bored, you want to entertain them. Or when they're angry, we calm them down. And it's really important to teach kids, how do you calm yourself down? How do you cheer yourself up? How do you deal with being bored? When we give them those skills, I think we set them up for a huge advantage in life, and it will come in handy whether, no matter what they do, whether you have a child who's going to go to college or one who isn't, but for their relationships, for everything. Because what good does it do to raise a child who can't control his temper or to raise a child who can't stand being alone? And I think our world right now is conducive to not teaching kids those skills. They have electronics and they have all these other opportunities to escape their feelings. But we really need to take a step back and make sure that we're teaching them the skills that they're going to need for life.
Amy, our show is called Nobody Told Me. And we always ask our guests, what is your Nobody Told Me lesson? What is it that nobody told you or could have told you on this journey that you've embarked on in terms of thinking about what makes people mentally strong?
I think nobody told me that mental muscle is a lot like building physical muscle. It was things that I learned by watching people, but nobody told it to me in grad school or anything else, that just like if you wanted to be physically strong, you can go to the gym and you can work out. Same as for mental strength. If you want to become mentally strong, there are lots of exercises you can do to reach your greatest potential in life.
Amy, tell us about where people can reach you online.
My website is Amy Morin, LCSW is in licensed clinical social worker.com. And I have links to my social media accounts and my TEDx talk on there.
And you also have an e-course that people can sign up for as well. Can you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, I was getting a lot of emails from readers who say, okay, I've read your book and I want more information on mental strength. I want to figure out what else I can do. So I created an online course that is divided up into sections to really say, okay, how do you get better control of your mind? How do you think differently? And then how do you manage your emotions? Which emotions are you uncomfortable with? Which ones seem to dictate your life? How do you figure out how to regulate your feelings better? And then the third part is about how do you take positive action? Now that you figured out how do you think realistically, how do you manage your emotions? And now how are you going to take the first steps to changing your life, even when you don't feel like it or when you're struggling with motivation? And we have students in 52 different countries. It's a you can take it whenever you want. It's at your own pace. So if you want to do it all in a couple of days, you can. Or if you want to do one module a week, you can do that too and then really apply it. But it's got a workbook. It's got some lectures. It's got different graphics in there. But it's really about figuring out how do you put mental strength to work in your life and how do you keep building a mental strength exercise routine so that you can become stronger as time goes on.
And again, the place to find that is Amy Morin. lcsw.com. Amy, thank you so very much for joining us. It's been a real pleasure, and we've learned a lot. I think we could talk for hours and hours.
Yeah,
on
we hope
topic.
You'll come back and we can talk more with you.
Oh, I would, anytime. Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much. Again, that is Amy Morin. Her books are 13 Things Mentally Strong People Don't Do, as well as 13 Things Mentally Strong Parents Don't Do. And again, her website, amymorinlcsw.com.
You're listening to Nobody Told Me. I'm Laura Owens.
And I'm Jan Black. Thank you for joining us.